epidemic, but in either case it was ferocious. World War I killed 21 million people in 4 years. Swine flu did the same in its first 4 months. Almost 80% of American casualties in the First World War came not from enemy fire, but from flu. In some units, the mortality rate was as high as 80%. Swine flu arose as a normal, non-lethal flu in the spring of 1918, but somehow, over the following months, no one knows how or where, it mutated into something more severe. A fifth of victims suffered only mild symptoms, but the rest became gravely ill and often died. Some succumbed within hours, others held on for a few days. In the United States, the first deaths were recorded among sailors in Boston in late August 1918, but the epidemic quickly spread to all parts of the country. Schools closed, public entertainments were shut down, people everywhere wore masks. It did little good. Between the autumn of 1918 and spring of the following year, 548,452 people died of the flu in America. The toll in Britain was 220,000, with similar numbers dead in France and Germany. No one knows the global toll, as records in the Third World were often poor, but it was not less than 20 million, and probably more like 50 million. Some estimates have put the global total as high as 100 million. In an attempt to devise a vaccine, medical authorities conducted tests on volunteers at a military prison on Deer Island in Boston Harbor. The prisoners were promised pardons if they survived a battery of tests. These tests were rigorous, to say the least. First, the subjects were injected with infected lung tissue taken from the dead, and then sprayed in the eyes, nose, and mouth with infectious aerosols. If they still failed to succumb, they had their throats swabbed with discharges taken from the sick and dying. If all else failed, they were required to sit open-mouthed while a gravely ill victim was helped to cough into their faces. Out of, somewhat amazingly, 300 men who volunteered, the doctors chose 62 for the tests. None contracted the flu. Not one. The only person who did grow ill was the ward doctor, who swiftly died. The probable explanation for this is that the epidemic had passed through the prison a few weeks earlier, and the volunteers, all of whom had survived that visitation, had natural immunity. Much about the 1918 flu is understood poorly or not at all. One mystery is how it erupted suddenly, all over, in places separated by oceans, mountain ranges, and other earthly impediments. A virus can survive for no more than a few hours outside a host body, so how could it appear in Madrid, Bombay, and Philadelphia all in the same week? The probable answer is that it was incubated and spread by people who had only slight symptoms or none at all. Even in normal outbreaks, about 10% of people have the flu, but are unaware of it because they experience no ill effects. And because they remain in circulation, they tend to be the great spreaders of the disease. That would account for the 1918 outbreak's widespread distribution, but it still doesn't explain how it managed to lay low for several months before erupting so explosively at more or less the same time all over. Even more mysterious is that it was primarily devastating to people in the prime of life. Flu normally is hardest on infants and the elderly, but in the 1918 outbreak, deaths were overwhelmingly among people in their 20s and 30s. Older people may have benefited from a resistance gained from earlier exposure to the same strain, but why the very young were similarly spared is unknown. The greatest mystery of all is why the 1918 flu was so ferociously deadly, when most flus are not. We still have no idea. From time to time, certain strains of virus return. A disagreeable Russian virus known as H1N1 caused severe outbreaks over wide areas in 1933, then again in the 1950s, and yet again in the 1970s. Where it went in the meantime each time is uncertain. One suggestion is that viruses hide out unnoticed in populations of wild animals before trying their hand at a new generation of humans. No one can rule out the possibility that the great swine flu epidemic might once again rear its head. And if it doesn't, others well might. New and frightening viruses crop up all the time. Ebola, Lassa, and Marburg fevers all have tended to flare up and die down again, but no one can say that they aren't quietly mutating away somewhere, or simply awaiting the right opportunity to burst forth in a catastrophic manner. It is now apparent that AIDS has been among us much longer than anyone originally suspected. Researchers at the Manchester Royal Infirmary in England discovered that a sailor who had died of mysterious, untreatable causes in 1959, in fact, had AIDS. But for whatever reasons, the disease remained generally quiescent for another 20 years. The miracle is that other such diseases haven't gone rampant. Lassa fever, which wasn't first detected until 1969 in West Africa, is extremely virulent and little understood. In 1969, a doctor at a Yale University lab in New Haven, Connecticut, who was studying Lassa fever, came down with it. He survived, but, more alarmingly, a technician in a nearby lab with no direct exposure also contracted the disease and died. Happily, the outbreak stopped there. But we can't count on such good fortune always. Our lifestyles invite epidemics. Air travel makes it possible to spread infectious agents across the planet with amazing ease. An Ebola virus could begin the day in, say, Benin, and finish it in New York or Hamburg or Nairobi or all three. It means also that medical authorities increasingly need to be acquainted with pretty much every malady that exists everywhere. But of course they're not. In 1990, a Nigerian living in Chicago was exposed to Lassa fever on a visit to his homeland, but didn't develop symptoms until he had returned to the United States. He died in a Chicago hospital without diagnosis, and without anyone taking any special precautions in treating him, unaware that he had one of the most lethal and infectious diseases on the planet. Miraculously, no one else was infected. We may not be so lucky next time. And on that sobering note, it's time to return to the world of the visibly living. 21. Life goes on. It isn't easy to become a fossil. The fate of nearly all living organisms, over 99.9% of them, is to compost down to nothingness. When your spark is gone, every molecule you own will be nibbled off you or sluiced away to be put to use in some other system. That's just the way it is. Even if you make it into the small pool of organisms, the less than 0.1% that don't get devoured, the chances of being fossilized are very small. In order to become a fossil, several things must happen. First, you must die in the right place. Only about 15% of rocks can preserve fossils, so it's no good keeling over on a future site of granite. In practical terms, the deceased must become buried in sediment, where it can leave an impression, like a leaf in wet mud, or decompose without exposure to oxygen, permitting the molecules in its bones and hard parts, and very occasionally softer parts, to be replaced by dissolved minerals, creating a petrified copy of the original. Then, as the sediments in which the fossil lies are carelessly pressed and folded and pushed about by Earth's processes, the fossil must somehow maintain an identifiable shape. Finally, but above all, after tens of millions, or perhaps hundreds of millions of years hidden away, it must be found and recognized as something worth keeping. Only about one bone in a billion, it is thought, ever becomes fossilized. If that is so, it means that the complete fossil legacy of all the Americans alive today, that's 270 million people with 206 bones each, will only be about 50 bones, one quarter of a complete skeleton. That's not to say, of course, that any of these bones will actually be found. Bearing in mind that they can be buried anywhere within an area of slightly over 3.6 million square miles, little of which will ever be turned over, much less examined, it would be something of a miracle if they were. Fossils are, in every sense, vanishingly rare. Most of what has lived on Earth has left behind no record at all. It has been estimated that less than one species in 10,000 has made it into the fossil record. That in itself is a stunningly infinitesimal proportion. However, if you accept the common estimate that the Earth has produced 30 billion species of creature in its time, and Richard Leakey and Roger Lewin's statement in The Sixth Extinction that there are 250,000 species of creature in the fossil record, that reduces the proportion to just 1 in 120,000. Either way, what we possess is the merest sampling of all the life that Earth has spawned. Moreover, the record we do have is hopelessly skewed. Most land animals, of course, don't die in sediments. They drop in the open and are eaten, or left to rot, or weather down to nothing. The fossil record, consequently, is almost absurdly biased in favour of marine creatures. About 95% of all the fossils we possess are of animals that once lived underwater, mostly in shallow seas. I mention all this to explain why, on a grey day in February, I went to the Natural History Museum in London to meet a cheerful, vaguely rumpled, very likeable paleontologist named Richard Forte. Forte knows an awful lot about an awful lot. He is the author of a wry, splendid book called Life, an Unauthorized Biography, which covers the whole pageant of animate creation. But his first love is a type of marine creature called trilobites, that once teemed in Ordovician seas, but haven't existed for a long time except in fossilized form. All shared a basic body plan of three parts, or lobes, head, tail, thorax, from which comes the name. Forte found his first when he was a boy clambering over rocks at St. David's Bay in Wales. He was hooked for life. He took me to a gallery of tall metal cupboards. Each cupboard was filled with shallow drawers, and each drawer was filled with stony trilobites, 20,000 specimens in all. "It seems like a big number," he agreed, "but you have to remember that millions upon millions of trilobites lived for millions upon millions of years in ancient seas, so 20,000 isn't a huge number, and most of these are only partial specimens. Finding a complete trilobite fossil is still a big moment for a paleontologist." Trilobites first appeared, fully formed, seemingly from nowhere, about 540 million years ago, near the start of the great outburst of complex life, popularly known as the Cambrian Explosion, and then vanished, along with a great deal else, in the great and still mysterious Permian Extinction, 300,000 or so centuries later. As with all extinct creatures, there is a natural temptation to regard them as failures. But in fact, they were among the most successful animals ever to live. Their reign ran for 300 million years, twice the span of dinosaurs, which were themselves one of history's great survivors. Humans, Forte points out, have survived so far for 0.5% as long. With so much time at their disposal, the trilobites proliferated prodigiously. Most remained small, about the size of modern beetles, but some grew to be as big as platters. Altogether they formed at least 5,000 genera and 60,000 species, though more turn up all the time. Forte had recently been at a conference in South America, where he was approached by an academic from a small provincial university in Argentina. She had a box that was full of interesting things, trilobites that had never been seen before in South America, or indeed anywhere, and a great deal else. She had no research facilities to study them, and no funds to look for more. Huge parts of the world are still unexplored. In terms of trilobites? No, in terms of everything. Throughout the 19th century, trilobites were almost the only known forms of early complex life, and for that reason were assiduously collected and studied.
This book is continued on Disc 11. Disc 11.
Throughout the 19th century, trilobites were almost the only known forms of early complex life, and for that reason were assiduously collected and studied. The big mystery about them was their sudden appearance. Even now, as Forte says, it can be startling to go to the right formation of rocks and to work your way upward through the eons, finding no visible life at all, and then suddenly a whole Prophalotaspis or Elenellus as big as a crab will pop into your waiting hands. These were creatures with limbs, gills, nervous systems, probing antennae, a brain of sorts, in Forte's words, and the strangest eyes ever seen. Made of calcite rods, the same stuff that forms limestone, they constituted the earliest visual systems known. More than this, the earliest trilobites didn't consist of just one venturesome species, but dozens, and didn't appear in one or two locations, but all over. Many thinking people in the 19th century saw this as proof of God's handiwork and refutation of Darwin's evolutionary ideals. If evolution proceeded slowly, they asked, then how did he account for this sudden appearance of complex, fully formed creatures? The fact is, he couldn't. And so matters seemed destined to remain forever, until one day in 1909, 3 months shy of the 50th anniversary of the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species, when a paleontologist named Charles Doolittle Walcott made an extraordinary find in the Canadian Rockies. Walcott was born in 1850, and grew up near Utica, New York, in a family of modest means, which became more modest still with the sudden death of his father when Walcott was an infant. As a boy, Walcott discovered that he had a knack for finding fossils, particularly trilobites, and built up a collection of sufficient distinction that it was bought by Louis Agassiz for his museum at Harvard for a small fortune, about $70,000 in today's money. Although he had barely a high school education and was self-taught in the sciences, Walcott became a leading authority on trilobites and was the first person to establish that trilobites were arthropods, the group that includes modern insects and crustaceans. In 1879, he took a job as a field researcher with the newly formed United States Geological Survey, and served with such distinction that within 15 years he had risen to be its head. In 1907, he was appointed secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, where he remained until his death in 1927. Despite his administrative obligations, he continued to do field work and to write prolifically. His books fill a library shelf, according to Forte. Not incidentally, he was also a founding director of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, which eventually became the National Aeronautics and Space Agency, or NASA, and thus can rightly be considered the grandfather of the space age. But what he is remembered for now is an astute but lucky find in British Columbia, high above the little town of Field in the late summer of 1909. The customary version of the story is that Walcott, accompanied by his wife, was riding on horseback on a mountain trail beneath the spot called the Burgess Ridge, when his wife's horse slipped on loose stones. Dismounting to assist her, Walcott discovered that the horse had turned a slab of shale that contained fossil crustaceans of an especially ancient and unusual type. Snow was falling. Winter comes early to the Canadian Rockies, so they didn't linger. But the next year, at the first opportunity, Walcott returned to the spot. Tracing the presumed route of the rock's slide, he climbed 750 feet to near the mountain's summit. There, 8,000 feet above sea level, he found a shale outcrop, about the length of a city block, containing an unrivaled array of fossils from soon after the moment when complex life burst forth in dazzling profusion, the famous Cambrian explosion. Walcott had found, in effect, the holy grail of paleontology. The outcrop became known as the Burgess Shale, and for a long time it provided our sole vista upon the inception of modern life in all its fullness, as the late Stephen Jay Gould recorded in his popular book Wonderful Life. Gould, ever scrupulous, discovered from reading Walcott's diaries that the story of the Burgess Shale's discovery appears to have been somewhat embroidered. Walcott makes no mention of a slipping horse or falling snow, but there is no disputing that it was an extraordinary find. It is almost impossible for us, whose time on earth is limited to a breezy few decades, to appreciate how remote in time from us the Cambrian outburst was. If you could fly backwards into the past at the rate of 1 year per second, it would take you about half an hour to reach the time of Christ, and a little over 3 weeks to get back to the beginnings of human life. But it would take you 20 years to reach the dawn of the Cambrian period. It was, in other words, an extremely long time ago, and the world was a very different place. For one thing, 500 million-plus years ago, when the Burgess Shale was formed, it wasn't at the top of a mountain, but at the foot of one, Specifically, it was a shallow ocean basin at the bottom of a steep cliff. The seas of that time teemed with life, but normally the animals left no record because they were soft-bodied and decayed upon dying. But at Burgess the cliff collapsed, and the creatures below, entombed in a mudslide, were pressed like flowers in a book, their features preserved in wondrous detail. In annual summer trips from 1910 to 1925, by which time he was 75 years old, Walcott excavated tens of thousands of specimens. Gould says 80,000. The normally unimpeachable fact-checkers of National Geographic say 60,000, which he brought back to Washington for further study. In both sheer numbers and diversity, the collection was unparalleled. Some of the Burgess fossils had shells, many others did not. Some were sighted, others blind. The variety was enormous, consisting of 140 species by one count. The Burgess shale included a range of disparity in anatomical designs never again equaled, and not matched today by all the creatures in the world's oceans, Gould wrote. Unfortunately, according to Gould, Walcott failed to discern the significance of what he had found. Snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, Gould wrote in another work, Eight Little Piggies, Walcott then proceeded to misinterpret these magnificent fossils in the deepest possible way. He placed them into modern groups, making them ancestral to today's worms, jellyfish, and other creatures, and thus failed to appreciate their distinctness. Under such an interpretation, Gould sighed, life began in primordial simplicity and moved inexorably, predictably onward to more and better. Walcott died in 1927, and the Burgess fossils were largely forgotten. For nearly half a century they stayed shut away in drawers in the American Museum of Natural History in Washington, seldom consulted and never questioned. Then, in 1973, a graduate student from Cambridge University named Simon Conway Morris paid a visit to the collection. He was astonished by what he found. The fossils were far more varied and magnificent than Walcott had indicated in his writings. In taxonomy, the category that describes the basic body plans of all organisms is the phylum, and here, Conway Morris concluded, were drawer after drawer of such anatomical singularities, all amazingly and unaccountably unrecognized by the man who had found them. With his supervisor, Harry Whittington, and fellow graduate student Derek Briggs, Conway Morris spent the next several years making a systematic revision of the entire collection, and cranking out one exciting monograph after another as discovery piled upon discovery. Many of the creatures employed body plans that were not simply unlike anything seen before or since. They were bizarrely different. One, Opabinia, had five eyes and a nozzle-like snout with claws on the end. Another, a disc-shaped being called Petoia, looked almost comically like a pineapple slice. A third had evidently tottered about on rows of stilt-like legs, and was so odd that they named it Hallucigenia. There was so much unrecognized novelty in the collection that at one point, upon opening a new drawer, Conway Morris famously was heard to mutter, "Oh, fuck, not another phylum." The English team's revisions showed that the Cambrian had been a time of unparalleled innovation and experimentation in body designs. For almost 4 billion years, life had dawdled along without any detectable ambitions in the direction of complexity, and then suddenly, in the space of just 5 or 10 million years, it had created all the basic body designs still in use today. Name a creature, from a nematode worm to Cameron Diaz, and they all use architecture first created in the Cambrian party. What was most surprising, however, was that there were so many body designs that had failed to make the cut, so to speak, and left no descendants. Altogether, according to Gould, at least 15 and perhaps as many as 20 of the Burgess animals belonged to no recognized phylum. The number soon grew in some popular accounts to as many as 100, far more than the Cambridge scientists ever actually claimed. "The history of life," wrote Gould, "is a story of massive removal followed by differentiation within a few surviving stocks, not the conventional tale of steadily increasing excellence, complexity, and diversity. Evolutionary success, it appeared, was a lottery. One creature that did manage to slip through, a small worm-like being called Picaea gracilens, was found to have a primitive spinal column, making it the earliest known ancestor of all later vertebrates, including us. Picaea were by no means abundant among the Burgess fossils, so goodness knows how close they may have come to extinction. Gould, in a famous quotation, leaves no doubt that he sees our lineal success as a fortunate fluke. Wind back the tape of life to the early days of the Burgess Shale. Let it play again from an identical starting point, and the chance becomes vanishingly small that anything like human intelligence would grace the replay. Gould's book was published in 1989 to general critical acclaim, and was a great commercial success. What wasn't generally known was that many scientists didn't agree with Gould's conclusions at all, and that it was all soon to get very ugly. In the context of the Cambrian, explosion would soon have more to do with modern tempers than ancient physiological facts. In fact, we now know, complex organisms existed at least 100 million years before the Cambrian. We should have known a whole lot sooner. Nearly 40 years after Walcott made his discovery in Canada, on the other side of the planet, in Australia, a young geologist named Reginald Sprigg found something even older, and in its way just as remarkable. In 1946, Sprigg was a young assistant government geologist for the state of South Australia, when he was sent to make a survey of abandoned mines in the Ediacaran Hills of the Flinders Range, an expanse of baking outback some 300 miles north of Adelaide. The idea was to see if there were any old mines that might be profitably reworked using newer technologies. So he wasn't studying surface rocks at all, still less fossils, but one day, while eating his lunch, Sprigg idly overturned a hunk of sandstone, and was surprised, to put it mildly, to see that the rock's surface was covered in delicate fossils, rather like the impressions leaves make in mud. These rocks predated the Cambrian explosion. He was looking at the dawn of visible life. Sprigg submitted a paper to Nature, but it was turned down. He read it instead at the next annual meeting of the Australian and New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science, but it failed to find favour with the association's head, who said the Ediacaran imprints were merely fortuitous inorganic markings, patterns made by wind or rain or tides, but not living beings. His hopes not yet entirely crushed, Sprigg travelled to London and presented his findings to the 1948 International Geological Congress, but failed to excite either interest or belief. Finally, for want of a better outlet, he published his findings in the Transactions of the Royal Society of South Australia. Then he quit his government job and took up oil exploration. 9 years later, in 1957, a schoolboy named John Mason, while walking through Charnwood Forest in the English Midlands, found a rock with a strange fossil in it, similar to a modern sea pen and exactly like some of the specimens Sprigg had found and been trying to tell everyone about ever since. The schoolboy turned it in to a paleontologist at the University of Leicester, who identified it at once as pre-Cambrian. Young Mason got his picture in the papers and was treated as a precocious hero. He still is in many books. The specimen was named in his honour, Chamia Masoni. Today, some of Sprigg's original Ediacaran specimens, along with many of the other 1,500 specimens that have been found throughout the Flinders Range since that time, can be seen in a glass case in an upstairs room of the stout and lovely South Australian Museum in Adelaide, but they don't attract a great deal of attention. The delicately etched patterns are rather faint and not terribly arresting to the untrained eye. They are mostly small and disc-shaped, with occasional vague trailing ribbons. Forte has described them as soft-bodied oddities. There is still very little agreement about what these things were or how they lived. They had, as far as can be told, no mouth or anus with which to take in and discharge digestive materials, and no internal organs with which to process them along the way. In life, Forte says, most of them probably simply lay upon the surface of the sandy sediment, like soft, structureless, and inanimate flatfish. At their liveliest, they were no more complex than jellyfish. All the Ediacaran creatures were diploblastic, meaning they were built from two layers of tissue. With the exception of jellyfish, all animals today are triploblastic. Some experts think they weren't animals at all, but more like plants or fungi. The distinctions between plant and animal are not always clear even now. The modern sponge spends its life fixed to a single spot and has no eyes or brain or beating heart, and yet is an animal. When we go back to the Precambrian, the differences between plants and animals were probably even less clear, says Forte. There isn't any rule that says you have to be demonstrably one or the other. Nor is it agreed that the Ediacaran organisms are in any way ancestral to anything alive today, except possibly some jellyfish. Many authorities see them as a kind of failed experiment, a stab at complexity that didn't take, possibly because the sluggish Ediacaran organisms were devoured or outcompeted by the lither and more sophisticated animals of the Cambrian period. There is nothing closely similar alive today, Forte has written. They are difficult to interpret as any kind of ancestors of what was to follow. The feeling was that ultimately they weren't terribly important to the development of life on Earth. Many authorities believe that there was a mass extermination at the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary, and that all the Ediacaran creatures, except the uncertain jellyfish, failed to move on to the next phase. The real business of complex life, in other words, started with the Cambrian explosion. That's how Gould saw it, in any case. As for the revisions of the Burgess Shale fossils, almost at once people began to question the interpretations, and in particular, Gould's interpretation of the interpretations. From the first, there were a number of scientists who doubted the account that Steve Gould had presented, however much they admired the manner of its delivery, Forte wrote in Life. That is putting it mildly. If only Stephen Gould could think as clearly as he writes, barked the Oxford academic Richard Dawkins, in the opening line of a review in the London Sunday Telegraph of Wonderful Life. Dawkins acknowledged that the book was unputdownable and a literary tour de force, but accused Gould of engaging in a grandiloquent and near disingenuous misrepresentation of the facts by suggesting that the Burgess revisions had stunned the paleontological community. The view that he is attacking, that evolution marches inexorably toward a pinnacle such as man, has not been believed for 50 years, Dawkins fumed. And yet that was exactly the conclusion to which many general reviewers were drawn. One, writing in the New York Times Book Review, cheerfully suggested that as a result of Gould's book, scientists have been throwing out some preconceptions that they had not examined for generations. They are reluctantly or enthusiastically accepting the idea that humans are as much an accident of nature as a product of orderly development. But the real heat directed at Gould arose from the belief that many of his conclusions were simply mistaken or carelessly inflated. Writing in the journal Evolution, Dawkins attacked Gould's assertions that evolution in the Cambrian was a different kind of process from today, and expressed exasperation at Gould's repeated suggestions that the Cambrian was a period of evolutionary experiment, evolutionary trial and error, evolutionary false starts. It was the fertile time when all the great fundamental body plans were invented. Nowadays, evolution just tinkers with old body plans. Back in the Cambrian, new phyla and new classes arose. Nowadays, we only get new species. Noting how often this idea, that there are no new body plans, is picked up, Dawkins says, "It is as though a gardener looked at an oak tree and remarked wonderingly, 'Isn't it strange that no major new boughs have appeared on this tree for many years? These days all the new growth appears to be at the twig level.'" It was a strange time, Forte says now, especially when you reflected that this was all about something that happened 500 million years ago, but feelings really did run quite high. I joked in one of my books that I felt as if I ought to put a safety helmet on before writing about the Cambrian period, but it did actually feel a bit like that. Strangest of all was the response of one of the heroes of Wonderful Life, Simon Conway Morris, who startled many in the paleontological community by rounding abruptly on Gould in a book of his own, The Crucible of Creation. The book treated Gould with contempt, even loathing, in Forte's words. "I have never encountered such spleen in a book by a professional," Forte wrote later. "The casual reader of The Crucible of Creation, unaware of the history, would never gather that the author's views had once been close to, if not actually shared with, Gould's." When I asked Forte about it, he said, "Well, it was very strange, quite shocking, really, because Gould's portrayal of him had been so flattering, I could only assume that Simon was embarrassed. You know, science changes, but books are permanent, and I suppose he regretted being so irremediably associated with views that he no longer altogether held. There was all that stuff about, oh, fuck, another phylum, and I expect he regretted being famous for that." What happened was that the early Cambrian fossils began to undergo a period of critical reappraisal. Forte and Derek Briggs, one of the other principals in Gould's book, used a method known as cladistics to compare the various Burgess fossils. In simple terms, cladistics consists of organizing organisms on the basis of shared features. Forte gives, as an example, the idea of comparing a shrew and an elephant. If you considered the elephant's large size and striking trunk, you might conclude that it could have little in common with a tiny, sniffing shrew. But if you compared both of them with a lizard, you would see that the elephant and shrew were in fact built to much the same plan. In essence, what Forte is saying is that Gould saw elephants and shrews where they saw mammals. The Burgess creatures, they believed, weren't as strange and various as they appeared at first sight. "They were often no stranger than trilobites," Forte says now. "It is just that we have had a century or so to get used to trilobites. Familiarity, you know, breeds familiarity." This wasn't, I should note, because of sloppiness or inattention. Interpreting the forms and relationships of ancient animals on the basis of often distorted and fragmentary evidence is clearly a tricky business. Edward O. Wilson has noted that if you took selected species of modern insects and presented them as Burgess-style fossils, nobody would ever guess that they were all from the same phylum, so different to their body plans. Also instrumental in helping revisions were the discoveries of two further early Cambrian sites, one in Greenland and one in China, plus more scattered finds, which between them yielded many additional and often better specimens. The upshot is that the Burgess fossils were found to be not so different after all. Hallucigenia, it turned out, had been reconstructed upside down. Its stilt-like legs were actually spikes along its back. Petoia, the weird creature that looked like a pineapple slice, was found to be not a distinct creature, but merely part of a larger animal called Anomalocaris. Many of the Burgess specimens have now been assigned to living phyla, just where Walcott put them in the first place. Hallucigenia and some others are thought to be related to Onychophora, a group of caterpillar-like animals. Others have been reclassified as precursors of the modern annelids. "In fact," says Forte, "there are relatively few Cambrian designs that are wholly novel. More often they turn out to be just interesting elaborations of well-established designs." As he wrote in his book, Life, "None was as strange as a present-day barnacle, nor as grotesque as a queen termite." So the Burgess shale specimens weren't so spectacular after all. This made them, as Forte has written, no less interesting or odd, just more explicable. Their weird body plans were just a kind of youthful exuberance, the evolutionary equivalent, as it were, of spiked hair and tongue studs. Eventually the forms settled into a staid and stable middle age. But that still left the enduring question of where all these animals had come from, how they had suddenly appeared from out of nowhere. Alas, it turns out the Cambrian explosion may not have been quite so explosive as all that. The Cambrian animals, it is now thought, were probably there all along, but were just too small to see. Once again it was trilobites that provided the clue, in particular that seemingly mystifying appearance of different types of trilobite in widely scattered locations around the globe, all at more or less the same time. On the face of it, the sudden appearance of lots of fully formed but varied creatures would seem to enhance the miraculousness of the Cambrian outburst, but in fact it did the opposite. It is one thing to have one well-formed creature like a trilobite burst forth in isolation. That really is a wonder. But to have many of them, all distinct but clearly related, turning up simultaneously in the fossil record in places as far apart as China and New York, clearly suggests that we are missing a big part of their history. There could be no stronger evidence that they simply had to have a forebear, some grandfather species that started the line in a much earlier past. And the reason we haven't found these earlier species, it is now thought, is that they were too tiny to be preserved. Says Forte, "It isn't necessary to be big to be a perfectly functioning, complex organism. The sea swarms with tiny arthropods today that have left no fossil record." He cites the little copepod, which numbers in the trillions in modern seas and clusters in shoals large enough to turn vast areas of the ocean black, and yet our total knowledge of its ancestry is a single specimen found in the body of an ancient fossilized fish. The Cambrian explosion, if that's the word for it, probably was more an increase in size than a sudden appearance of new body types, Forte says, and it could have happened quite swiftly, so in that sense I suppose it was an explosion. The idea is that just as mammals bided their time for 100 million years until the dinosaurs cleared off and then seemingly burst forth in profusion all over the planet, so too perhaps the arthropods and other triploblasts waited in semi-microscopic anonymity for the dominant Ediacaran organisms to have their day. Says Forte, "We know that mammals increased in size quite dramatically after the dinosaurs went, though when I say quite abruptly, I, of course, mean it in a geological sense. We're still talking millions of years." Incidentally, Reginald Sprigg did eventually get a measure of overdue credit. One of the main early genera, Spriggina, was named in his honour, as were several species, and the whole became known as the Ediacaran fauna after the hills through which he had searched. By this time, however, Sprigg's fossil hunting days were long over. After leaving geology, he founded a successful oil company and eventually retired to an estate in his beloved Flinders Range, where he created a wildlife reserve. He died in 1994, a rich man. 22. Goodbye to all that. When you consider it from a human perspective, and clearly it would be difficult for us to do otherwise, life is an odd thing. It couldn't wait to get going, but then, having gotten going, it seemed in very little hurry to move on. Consider the lichen. Lichens are just about the hardiest visible organisms on Earth, but among the least ambitious. They will grow happily enough in a sunny churchyard, but they particularly thrive in environments where no other organism would go, on blowy mountain tops and arctic wastes, wherever there is little but rock and rain and cold and almost no competition. In areas of Antarctica, where virtually nothing else will grow, you can find vast expanses of lichen, 400 types of them, adhering devotedly to every wind-whipped rock. For a long time, people couldn't understand how they did it, because lichens grew on bare rock without evident nourishment or the production of seeds. Many people, educated people, believed they were stones caught in the process of becoming plants. "Spontaneously, inorganic stone becomes living plant," rejoiced one observer, a Dr. Homschutz, in 1819. Closer inspection showed that lichens were more interesting than magical. They are, in fact, a partnership between fungi and algae. The fungi excrete acids that dissolve the surface of the rock, freeing minerals that the algae convert into food sufficient to sustain both. It is not a very exciting arrangement, but it is a conspicuously successful one. The world has more than 20,000 species of lichens. Like most things that thrive in harsh environments, lichens are slow-growing. It may take a lichen more than half a century to attain the dimensions of a shirt button. Those the size of dinner plates, writes David Attenborough, are therefore likely to be hundreds, if not thousands, of years old. It would be hard to imagine a less fulfilling existence. They simply exist, Attenborough adds, testifying to the moving fact that life, even at its simplest level, occurs, apparently, just for its own sake. It is easy to overlook this thought that life just is. As humans, we are inclined to feel that life must have a point. We have plans and aspirations and desires. We want to take constant advantage of all the intoxicating existence we've been endowed with. But what's life to a lichen? Yet its impulse to exist, to be, is every bit as strong as ours, arguably even stronger. If I were told that I had to spend decades being a furry growth on a rock in the woods, I believe I would lose the will to go on. Lichens don't. Like virtually all living things, they will suffer any hardship, endure any insult, for a moment's additional existence. Life, in short, just wants to be. But, and here's an interesting point, for the most part it doesn't want to be much. This is perhaps a little odd, because life has had plenty of time to develop ambitions. If you imagine the 4,500 million-odd years of Earth's history compressed into a normal earthly day, then life begins very early, about 4 a.m., with the rise of the first simple single-celled organisms, but then advances no further for the next 16 hours. Not until about 8:30 in the evening, with a day 5/6 over, has Earth anything to show the universe but a restless skin of microbes. Then, finally, the first sea plants appear, followed 20 minutes later by the first jellyfish and the enigmatic Ediacaran fauna first seen by Reginald Sprigg in Australia. At 9:04 p.m., trilobites swim onto the scene, followed more or less immediately by the shapely creatures of the Burgess Shale. Just before 10 p.m., plants begin to pop up on the land. Soon after, with less than 2 hours left in the day, the first land creatures follow. Thanks to 10 minutes or so of balmy weather, by 10:24 the earth is covered in the great carboniferous forests, whose residues give us all our coal, and the first winged insects are evident. Dinosaurs plod onto the scene just before 11 p.m. and hold sway for about 3/4 of an hour. At 21 minutes to midnight they vanish, and the age of mammals begins. Humans emerge 1:17 before midnight. The whole of our recorded history on this scale would be no more than a few seconds. A single human lifetime, barely an instant. Throughout this greatly speeded-up day, continents slide about and bang together at a clip that seems positively reckless. Mountains rise and melt away, ocean basins come and go, ice sheets advance and withdraw. And throughout the whole, about 3 times every minute, somewhere on the planet there is a flashbulb pop of light marking the impact of a Manson-sized meteor, or one even larger. It's a wonder that anything at all can survive in such a pummeled and unsettled environment. In fact, not many things do for long. Perhaps an even more effective way of grasping our extreme recentness as a part of this 4.5-billion-year-old picture is to stretch your arms to their fullest extent and imagine that width as the entire history of the Earth. On this scale, according to John McPhee in Basin and Range, the distance from the fingertips of one hand to the wrist of the other is pre-Cambrian. All of complex life is in one hand, and in a single stroke with a medium-grained nail file you could eradicate human history. Fortunately, that moment hasn't happened, but the chances are good that it will. I don't wish to interject a note of gloom just at this point, but the fact is that there is one other extremely pertinent quality about life on Earth. It goes extinct, quite regularly. For all the trouble they take to assemble and preserve themselves, species crumple and die remarkably routinely. And the more complex they get, the more quickly they appear to go extinct, which is perhaps one reason why so much of life isn't terribly ambitious. So any time life does something bold, it is quite an event, and few occasions were more eventful than when life moved on to the next stage in our narrative and came out of the sea. Land was a formidable environment, hot, dry, bathed in intense ultraviolet radiation, lacking the buoyancy that makes movement in water comparatively effortless. To live on land, creatures had to undergo wholesale revisions of their anatomies. Hold a fish at each end, and it sags in the middle, its backbone too weak to support it. To survive out of water, marine creatures needed to come up with new, load-bearing internal architecture, not the sort of adjustment that happens overnight. Above all, and most obviously, any land creature would have to develop a way to take its oxygen directly from the air, rather than filter it from water. and these were not trivial challenges to overcome. On the other hand, there was a powerful incentive to leave the water. It was getting dangerous down there. The slow fusion of the continents into a single land mass, Pangaea, meant there was much, much less coastline than formerly, and thus much less coastal habitat. So competition was fierce. There was also an omnivorous and unsettling new type of predator on the scene, one so perfectly designed for attack that it has scarcely changed in all the long eons since its emergence. The shark. Never would there be a more propitious time to find an alternative environment to water. Plants began the process of land colonization about 450 million years ago, accompanied of necessity by tiny mites and other organisms that they needed to break down and recycle dead organic matter on their behalf. Larger animals took a little longer to emerge, but by about 400 million years ago they were venturing out of the water too. Popular illustrations have encouraged us to envision the first venturesome land dwellers as a kind of ambitious fish, something like the modern mudskipper, which can hop from puddle to puddle during droughts, or even as a fully formed amphibian. In fact, the first visible mobile residents on land were probably much more like modern woodlice, sometimes also known as pillibugs or sowbugs. These are the little bugs, crustaceans in fact, that are commonly thrown into confusion when you upturn a rock or log. For those that learned to breathe oxygen from the air, times were good. Oxygen levels in the Devonian and Carboniferous periods, when terrestrial life first bloomed, were as high as 35%, as opposed to nearer 20% now. This allowed animals to grow remarkably large, remarkably quickly. And how, you may reasonably wonder, can scientists know what oxygen levels were like hundreds of millions of years ago? The answer lies in a slightly obscure but ingenious field known as isotope geochemistry. The long-ago seas of the Carboniferous and Devonian swarmed with tiny plankton that wrapped themselves inside tiny protective shells. Then, as now, the plankton created their shells by drawing oxygen from the atmosphere and combining it with other elements, carbon especially, to form durable compounds such as calcium carbonate. It's the same chemical trick that goes on in, and is discussed elsewhere in relation to, the long-term carbon cycle, a process that doesn't make for terribly exciting narrative, but is vital for creating a livable planet. Eventually, in this process, all the tiny organisms die and drift to the bottom of the sea, where they are slowly compressed into limestone. Among the tiny atomic structures the plankton take to the grave with them are two very stable isotopes, oxygen-16 and oxygen-18. If you've forgotten what an isotope is, it doesn't matter, though for the record it's an atom with an abnormal number of neutrons. This is where the geochemists come in, for the isotopes accumulate at different rates depending on how much oxygen or carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere at the time of their creation. By comparing these ancient ratios, the geochemists can cunningly read conditions in the ancient world. Oxygen levels, air and ocean temperatures, the extent and timing of ice ages, and much else. By combining their isotope findings with other fossil residues, pollen levels, and so on, scientists can, with considerable confidence, recreate entire landscapes that no human eye ever saw. The principal reason oxygen levels were able to build up so robustly throughout the period of early terrestrial life was that much of the world's landscape was dominated by giant tree ferns and vast swamps, which, by their boggy nature, disrupted the normal carbon recycling process. Instead of completely rotting down, falling fronds and other dead vegetative matter accumulated in rich, wet sediments, which were eventually squeezed into the vast coal beds that sustain much economic activity even now. The heady levels of oxygen clearly encouraged outsized growth. The oldest indication of a surface animal yet found is a track left 350 million years ago by a millipede-like creature on a rock in Scotland. It was over 3 feet long. Before the era was out, some millipedes would reach lengths more than double that. With such creatures on the prowl, it is perhaps not surprising that insects in the period evolved a trick that could keep them safely out of tongue shot. They learned to fly. Some took to this new means of locomotion with such uncanny facility that they haven't changed their techniques in all the time since. Then, as now, dragonflies could cruise at up to 35 miles an hour, instantly stop, hover, fly backwards, and lift far more proportionately than any human flying machine. The U.S. Air Force, one commentator has written, has put them in wind tunnels to see how they do it, and despaired. They, too, gorged on the rich air. In carboniferous forests, dragonflies grew as big as ravens. Trees and other vegetation likewise attained outsized proportions. Horsetails and tree ferns grew to heights of 50 feet, club mosses to 130. The first terrestrial vertebrates, which is to say the first land animals from which we would derive, are something of a mystery. This is partly because of a shortage of relevant fossils, but partly also because of an idiosyncratic Swede named Erik Jarvik, whose odd interpretations and secretive manner held back progress on this question for almost half a century. Jarvik was part of a team of Scandinavian scholars who went to Greenland in the 1930s and 1940s looking for fossil fish. In particular, they sought lobe-finned fish of the type that presumably were ancestral to us and all other walking creatures, known as tetrapods. Most animals are tetrapods, and all living tetrapods have one thing in common: four limbs that end in a maximum of 5 fingers or toes. Dinosaurs, whales, birds, humans, even fish, all are tetrapods, which clearly suggests they come from a single common ancestor. The clue to this ancestor, it was assumed, would be found in the Devonian era, from about 400 million years ago. Before that time, nothing walked on land. After that time, lots of things did. Luckily, the team found just such a creature, a 3-foot-long animal called an ichthyostega. The analysis of the fossil fell to Jarvik, who began his study in 1948 and kept at it for the next 48 years. Unfortunately, Jarvik refused to let anyone study his tetrapod. The world's paleontologists had to be content with 2 sketchy interim papers in which Jarvik noted that the creature had 5 fingers in each of 4 limbs, confirming its ancestral importance. Jarvik died in 1998. After his death, other paleontologists eagerly examined the specimen and found that Jarvik had severely miscounted the fingers and toes. There were actually 8 on each limb, and failed to observe that the fish could not possibly have walked. The structure of the fin was such that it would have collapsed under its own weight. Needless to say, this did not do a great deal to advance our understanding of the first land animals. Today, 3 early tetrapods are known, and none has 5 digits. In short, we don't know quite where we came from. But come we did, though reaching our present state of eminence has not, of course, always been straightforward. Since life on land began, it has consisted of 4 mega-dynasties, as they are sometimes called. The first consisted of primitive, plodding, but sometimes fairly hefty amphibians and reptiles. The best-known animal of this age was the Dimetrodon, a sail-backed creature that is commonly confused with dinosaurs, including, I note, in a picture caption in the Carl Sagan book Comet. The Dimetrodon was, in fact, a synapsid. So, once upon a time, were we. Synapsids were one of the 4 main divisions of early reptilian life, the others being anapsids, euryapsids, and diapsids. The names simply refer to the number and location of small holes to be found in the sides of their owners' skulls. Synapsids had 1 hole in their lower temples. Diapsids had 2, euryapsids had a single hole higher up. Over time, each of these principal groupings split into further subdivisions, of which some prospered and some faltered. Anapsids gave rise to the turtles, which for a time, perhaps a touch improbably, appeared poised to predominate as the planet's most advanced and deadly species, before an evolutionary lurch let them settle for durability rather than dominance. The synapsids divided into 4 streams, only one of which survived beyond the Permian. Happily, that was the stream we belonged to, and it evolved into a family of proto-mammals known as therapsids. These formed Mega-Dynasty 2. Unfortunately for the therapsids, their cousins, the diapsids, were also productively evolving, in their case into dinosaurs, among other things, which gradually proved too much for the therapsids. Unable to compete head-to-head with these aggressive new creatures, the therapsids by and large vanished from the record. A very few, however, evolved into small, furry, burrowing beings that bided their time for a very long while as little mammals. The biggest of them grew no larger than a house cat, and most were no bigger than mice. Eventually this would prove their salvation, but they would have to wait nearly 150 million years for Mega Dynasty 3, the age of the dinosaurs, to come to an abrupt end and make room for Mega Dynasty